This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio and online Main Street across North Dakota. Today, we're going to look at 2020 again through the perspective of the pandemic that stretches into the new year and, of course, has been engaging the world in this struggle for months now. Today, we're going to look at a particular business that we will all eventually probably deal with, and we probably have a lot of questions about, particularly when we're dealing with a deadly virus. Alex Rydell is president of the North Dakota Funeral Directors Association, and he is a funeral director at Hanson Runsvold Funeral Home in Fargo. He joins us to talk about the business of funerals. Alex, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on, Doug.
What attracted you to this profession?
It was kind of an interesting path that I took to get into the funeral profession. I was a musician growing up, and a violinist specifically, and that was always kind of my path that I thought I would be pursuing for a career. And when I was in my first year of college at St. Olaf, playing in the orchestra, I always believed that I was called a different direction, kind of a 180 into funeral service. I actually was staying with a family as we were on orchestra tour in Loveland, Colorado, who were funeral directors. And I, in talking with them, through kind of about my parents' experiences as being nurses, and I just started inquiring about what it was like to be a funeral director. And they spoke to me about the compassion and showing up to help people in their darkest times, and just being a person who's out in the community and making sure, you know, it's a servant thing. And from the discussion that I had with them that night, that literally was the spark that drew me into this. And, you know, I ended up coming back and shadowing John Runsvold, who is the owner of the funeral home that I work at now. And everything clicked. I knew that I had a heart for serving and for helping people who were in need, and funeral service to me fit that. And I felt absolutely called into this profession. And so that started my path into funeral service, actually.
So you went to St. Olaf for music and you changed your direction. And briefly, what kind of educational preparation is required? What kind of licensure or whatever?
Sure. So each state has a little bit different licensure. Being in a border town where we're right next to Minnesota, Minnesota has a little bit lengthier education requirements. So I met those, which was it's a bachelor's degree in mortuary science is what I ended up receiving. So that is from the University of Minnesota in the Twin Cities. That's where the mortuary science program is and school that I graduated from.
You mentioned John Runsvold. Are most funeral homes family-owned businesses or corporations moving into this area?
Corporations have definitely been, you know, in the last, I would say, 30 years have been a part of funeral service in different parts of the country, some more so than others. You know, in the Midwest, especially in the Fargo-Moorhead community, they're all family-owned. And even, you know, you look at North Dakota and a wide, you know, part of Minnesota, still very much family-owned businesses. You get a little bit further out, you know, East Coast, West Coast, some of those bigger areas, there are corporate firms, and there's, you know, some familiar names in those, SCI and some of those firms. But for the majority still of the country, still mainly family-owned businesses.
Well, let's talk about the cloud that's hanging over everything right now, and that's COVID-19. It really turned everything upside down in 2020, and it still continues to rage out there. We have hopes for vaccines. We have concerns about new strains of the virus, all that kind of thing. What sorts of precautions were imposed on your business by the emergence of this dangerous virus?
Well, yeah, it's definitely been an interesting year, and so as far as precautions go, you know, we when things all came to head back in March. We immediately, as far as a state association of funeral directors, the state board of funeral service, everyone started coming together to make sure that we were communicating openly and making plans for how we were going to address this. It was initially, we were relying on the science community to help us understand what is this that we're dealing with. That being said, we have always in funeral service, we have always been taken universal precautions when it comes to caring for a person's body, a person who has died. So caring for a deceased human body. We've all always been taught to take universal precautions because you never know when we walk into a situation. There may be undiagnosed disease that a person has. There may be something we just don't hear about. And so because of that, we have to be extremely cautious when we're dealing with that. And so gowns, face masks, proper, scrubs and shoe coverings, gloves, everything that, normal proper protective equipment that's used, are things that we use in these situations. That being said, because it was a new virus, it was a new disease that we really, we didn't study about in school. It was something that we had to, step back and look at, listen to the science, find out what it is that they're telling us about this, and then go from there. And thankfully, most of us were prepared in advance. We here keep a larger stockpile than we need of proper protective equipment and preparation, embalming fluids, things like that for situations like this where we wouldn't necessarily see it coming, but there would be a sudden increase in the number of deaths that we're dealing with.
Alex Rydell is president of the North Dakota Funeral Directors Association. Alex, have you seen a number of COVID-19 victims?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have cared for quite a number of people who have died with COVID-19 and sometimes from COVID-19 as effects from it since March. And different times have been busier than others, but it has in many ways increased the number of families that we've been serving and people that we've been taking care of in the last year. Numbers wise, I mean, last year we were up like 25% as far as the number of families that we worked with. And I would it, that wasn't a direct all of those numbers were from COVID people who died from COVID-19, but I in looking back on it, I can absolutely see the and continued to or continue to see the effects from COVID-19 and the pandemic and what isolation has done to people. So we've seen all of the above. Now, it was initially back in March, it was kind of shocking, March, April, May, where it was complete shutdown and 10 people could get together. So we were having these incredibly intimate but sad situations where people would die in the hospital, their family couldn't be with them, and then on top of that, add to it that only 10 of the family members can be present at a funeral service. So it was this dramatic, and we're all looking at it going, how can this continue? How this just doesn't feel right. And thankfully we've had the ability to use the technology that we already had in place, and we're live streaming pretty much every funeral service that we do now. But it is so sad. It is so sad to see families who would love to have this large celebration of life where they welcome the community in, as we have, as humans have done since the beginning of time. When a loved one dies, we gather together, we reminisce and we mourn. And it has taken that thing away from us as we know it, and you know, we've had to adjust certainly, but you know, in terms of, you know, what we've seen as far as an effect goes, statewide, you know, we're not the only ones here, here in Fargo. Statewide, numbers have been higher, and I would attribute it to both, deaths from COVID-19, as well as from the effects of what the pandemic has done, to kind of society, I would say.
So the business, is more than just preparing the body. There are memorial services that you sometimes conduct on site. When I read obituaries these days, particularly they occasionally will now say that somebody died of COVID-19. And typically at the bottom of the obituary, there will be some message saying that there will be a memorial service in the future or something like that. Are you expecting at some point when all these vaccinations take place that there's going to be this huge bump in basically people getting together to remember that person they lost now months ago?
Yes. I would say, I don't know if I would say I'm expecting a huge bump. I expect that there will come a time when we will see an increase of, you know, we're coming back and, okay, it's now safe to have the service that we would like to have. I've thought about that a lot, and I think it's interesting because I don't know that there is going to be a black and white line of when it is now okay to do this. You know, as we've seen, things are so gradual and they're kind of back and forth, you know, 25% capacity for events and then 50% and then back to 25. And so it's kind of interesting to me to think about, you know, what's that going to look like in the future when that time comes and we're able to say, okay, it's safe. We've been kind of, you know, we've been operating here at the funeral home and statewide, really, the, you know, funeral directors have been getting together on sometimes weekly, sometimes monthly basis just to discuss things. And, you know, we're all operating within our local regulations and state regulations of, you know, what are the gathering sizes and what does the safety need to look like for gatherings like this? And so we're all doing that. And, you know, most of the time, to be honest, Doug, what I'm seeing is families, because we're now seeing that, you know, we're 9 months into this. And, you know, back in March and April, we were thinking, well, I don't know, it might be a couple months, before we're able to do this. And so there were times last spring where you'd probably see an obituary that said, well, a service will be held in the summer or in the late summer. Well, little did we know that we're still here next winter. And that's a long time for people to wait. And so because of that, we're having a lot more conversations with families about, you know, we don't know when it's going to be safe to say, you know, say 300-400 people would have come to dad's service if in normal times. We don't know when that's going to be a possibility to do. And so right now, because grief doesn't pause, you know, there's no putting a pause on our feelings and the need to have something. Most people are opting to now have some sort of small gathering and live stream it so that we can at least honor that person's life and acknowledge the feelings that we're having of loss and grief. And, you know, putting out that possibility of, yeah, I think we'll have another celebration that'll be a bigger gathering later on. We just don't know when it's going to be. So I don't know that it'll necessarily be a hard, all right, you know, come March of this year, that's when it's going to be open and we're going to start having big services again. But it will definitely, you know, it'll definitely come where there's going to be a time where we're going to be having more of those.
Alex Rydell is with Hanson Runsfold Funeral Home. He's president of the North Dakota Funeral Directors Association. Alex, you mentioned this earlier, and that is that you deal with people at an extreme moment in their lives, the families of people who have passed away. What kind of training prepares you for the kinds of compassionate interactions that you have to have?
Well, In mortuary school, there's different courses that we end up having to take in training towards funeral service. Of course, most people kind of think of the science portion of our job in caring for a person's body, but there's so much else that we work, psychology and sociology, and there's many courses in our coursework that address that, because in reality, when a person would look at, my day-to-day job, the majority of the time that I have spent is interacting with families and helping guide, through the process of loss. And so, so there is a large portion of our schooling, that addresses those things. I do believe that kind of the on-the-job training that we end up going through in funeral service is probably the most valuable. Being back in the community that I've been in, I've experienced so many different situations and different families that I've worked with, and I think that has lent itself, along with just training from funeral directors who I'm working with, who have been here for 30, 40 years, who have been funeral directors for that long. That's where I've gotten the most valuable, I think, training and education on how we can best be of service to families in a difficult time. To think of the fact, if I would have thought, you would have told me back in when I was in school that I would be a funeral director during a pandemic where we're having families who haven't seen their loved one for 2 months because they've been in the hospital and they couldn't go visit them. And now trying to help this family through that process and give that opportunity for them to see their loved one one last time. I couldn't have even imagined. But thanks to the training, I think it's really, it's been a really emotional time these last 9 months, but at the same time, I have never been more proud of my colleagues in funeral service in the state of North Dakota, who stepped up to the plate and who have guided all of these families through these difficult times. Everyone in the state has been so busy, and I talked to colleagues who there was one who said, I think I've worked the last 150 days without a day off, just because of how busy things have been in certain parts of the state. And but we continue to show up, everyone does, and I'm so proud of everyone for doing that.
Pre-planned and pre-financed funerals have been widely available now for years, and I assume these provide real advantages, particularly because the person for whom the funeral may be held can be involved in those discussions. But oftentimes, and with COVID-19, funerals involve accident victims or people who die unexpectedly. How do you weigh the needs of your business and compassion for the survivors? Because, you're selling caskets, you're selling other services, maybe a luncheon, maybe keepsakes. That's a difficult place to be, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always, since I even decided that I was going to go into funeral service, I kind of decided early on, it always has to be about the families first, and business will, as long as we are sticking to our core values of meeting a family's needs, whatever that might be and whatever that might look like, the business will come. The business will work out, and the numbers happen. Now, we will always have to take a look at numbers quarter to quarter and see where we're at and make sure that everyone of our staff is being taken care of and that we're able to pay bills and do that kind of thing. But the bottom line is that the families have needs, and when they walk into our doors broken and feeling feeling just at a loss because they've lost an important person in their life, someone that they love, we have to be able to meet them and be empathetic and give them what it is that they need and help them to see that. And there's something to as far as what it is that we do, We're meeting, you know, we get phone calls from people, and oftentimes what people will ask is very simple questions, things that that they might not, well, how much is it going to cost? You know, that's oftentimes the one of the first questions that that a family will ask when calling. And the reality is that might not be the main concern, but they're just not really sure what questions to ask. And so we are able to talk about the different options and, you know, help families to understand that what are we trying to do here? You know, we're trying to honor this person's life, honor the relationship that we had with that person, and to make sure to recognize that. And so, you know, it's definitely a fine line between it, but we here, and I know across the state, it's the same situation. You know, we focus on the family first, and everything will fill in if we are doing that first, and if we're paying attention to what the family's needs are.
When I was a boy, virtually all funerals involve someone who is embalmed in a casket who was then buried. Nowadays, there's cremation. There's an urn burial, perhaps, or scattering of ashes, or even green burials these days. How would you differentiate or describe the importance of those different ways of doing this to the business?
It's been very interesting to watch the different trends, if you will, happening in choices that have been made. You know, like you said, went back when you were young. Pretty much everyone was in a casket, and then they were buried at a cemetery. And over time, it's evolved, and cremation has become an option that has been very popular and is chosen more and more. And it's, you know, in North Dakota, it's you know, over 50% of the people who die in North Dakota, the final means of disposition is cremation. So it certainly is there. Green burials, as you said, I mean, that's another option as well. We have to look at it in funeral service. You know, we look at it in terms of, you know, what needs is this filling for the family, and so there's still the foundational needs of, you know, what does a funeral provide, or what does a memorial service provide? It provides an opportunity for us to talk about our loved one, to remember them, to share stories, and to, you know, just to honor that life. And so they all have that foundational, I think, principle, you know, meaning to them. It's just there's different means to getting to that point. And some things are more important to folks than others. And sometimes it's really important to a family to have that time to view a person's body and kind of have that realization of the physical, the end of that physical being. And other times that's not as important of an aspect to a family. And so cremation might come into play. There's also, you know, a lot of times that we have now where the person's body will be present in a casket for the service, followed by cremation, because a family sees that, you know, I think it's really important for the grandkids to be able to see grandpa's, you know, to kind of help them realize the loss. But, you know, grandpa wanted to be cremated and have his ashes scattered out at the farm. And so this is how we're going to meet all of those needs. And so it goes back to, you know, understanding what a person or what a family's needs are and how we can best meet that. And so because of that, there's all these, you know, different options that we have available to give to families so that we can hopefully meet them where they're at and make sure to fulfill those.
Alex Rydell is president of the North Dakota Funeral Directors Association. Thanks for spending time with us today, Alex.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Doug.
Coming up on Main Street, Nomadland is a movie, but it was a book before that. And next on our show, we'll hear from the author of Nomadland. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The chairman of the House Appropriations Committee is not a fan of bonding.
I'll certainly look at what's out there and see whatever, but, you know, my vote is it certainly won't be for $1 billion.
Republican Jeff Delzer says he will look at proposals that relate to infrastructure projects.
Maybe just a couple water ones that we don't have, maybe something for the state's roads if they can get the work done in the next 2 years. But the problem is if you start bonding and pretty soon you turn around and bond again, and then all you're doing is spending all your cash on bonding, and you have to bond every session to go ahead. And that's not good for the state.
Governor Burgum is proposing a $1.25 billion bonding program. Fargo Democratic Senator Tim Mathern has a $2 billion plan. And Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner says he will unveil his bonding proposal later this week. North Dakota has long dealt with a shortage of access to mental health care in rural areas, but efforts are ramping up to make sure treatment is available in hard-to-reach places. The University of North Dakota and Sanford Health are carving out a multi-phase project designed to provide more resources at a time when more people are feeling stressed because of the pandemic. Andrew McLean chairs the psychiatry department at the UND Medical School. He says early efforts included a webpage with helpful tips along with phone assessments. He says future phases could involve a more robust way of ensuring that patients can visit with a provider virtually, potentially closing gaps in some areas.
As you go into the western part of the state, you know, whether it's mental health providers or whether it's addiction counselors, there's a particular issue in terms of finding providers there.
McLean anticipates the demand for telemedicine, for telehealth, or for mental health issues will still be around after the pandemic. But he says as the planning takes shape, they know they will always be up against a key barrier.
I think we're never going to grow enough, you know, behavioral health providers. So I think what we'll be seeing is there will be a need for, you know, the ongoing virtual care, whether that will come from within state if we have enough people to do that, or some of the companies from outside.
But McLean warns there are still a lot of unknowns surrounding the next phases. He says that includes whether insurance companies would still allow for exemptions for virtual visits as they are right now during the crisis. And more discharge challenges for the Red River Biorefinery in Grand Forks. The company's wastewater treatment system has hit another snag that has resulted in stronger discharges from into the city's wastewater system. The net result is higher treatment needs than what is allowed in city code. Grand Forks Administrator Todd Feeland says the company does have a plan of action, but it will take some time.
It was really centered on receiving a load of bad biomass. And wastewater is a little bit different than water. When things go wrong in drinking water, you just put a lot of chemicals on it. With wastewater, it requires some biology, and when things don't go quite right, you just don't turn on a dime and fix the problem.
In October, the city waived certain penalty fees for the excess pollutants. As part of the latest 10-week extension, the city will require the company to stay current on a payment fee for the higher discharges. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The new movie, Nomadland, slated for release next month, is already getting a lot of buzz. It focuses on people who move around the country to follow their work. Academy Award-winning actress Frances McDormand plays a woman struggling to survive on Social Security and a pension. The film is based on the book, Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century. 2 years ago, our director of radio, Bill Thomas, spoke with author and journalist Jessica Bruder.
Hi, Jessica, and thanks so much for joining us today. And I liked your book a lot. I recommend it to other people, but it turned out to be quite a bit different than I expected. I was attracted to it because I caught that part of it happens in North Dakota. It's a nonfiction book about people who have given up their real estate for wheel estate. They've sold their house or gotten out of a rental situation and moved into a vehicle of some kind, usually an RV or a van. And I guess I was kind of expecting a little more sociological version of a book like The RV Life on a Tight Budget or something like that, or The Secrets of RVing on Social Security. And it is partly that, and it's partly also what I was expecting is kind of jolly, spunky people out there living the free life on the road. And there's some of that too, the great people that are told about in here. But it's also a lot about affordable housing and economics and the changing shape of retirement in our country.
Absolutely. It's a Venn diagram that hits all those points. You know, it's fascinating. I grew up, whenever I saw an RV, I thought, you know, there go the last of the great pensioners. They're going to Niagara Falls or they're going to the Grand Canyon, and how cool is that? But as I dug in to work on a magazine story, which then turned into this book, what I saw is that there's another group of people, many of whom found that their retirement dreams didn't quite work out the way they planned. Some of them lost their shirts in 2008. A lot of people lost equity in their homes. Other people found themselves trapped between flat wages and rising housing costs, which are a huge problem culturally right now. And because of that, saying, well, if my biggest expense is housing, what if I cut that and hit the road? And as it turns out, there's a network, a kind of a shadow economy with jobs all over the country that hire full-time nomads in RVs and vans. And that's actually what brought me up to Sakota, was for the annual sugar beet harvest, which is a pretty big employer of this demographic, which calls itself work campers.
Yes, and you got the mud exactly right. We know that mud, and you got to know it too. And we'll get to more of that later, but you're seeing people who've really been squeezed.
Perhaps it shouldn't have surprised me when you look at the economic picture. So if you go back to the late 1960s, one full-time minimum wage worker earned enough to lift a three-person family out of poverty. That same person doing that same work right now, that family is in poverty. We've had the federal minimum wage stall at $7.25 an hour for nearly a decade. Meanwhile, housing costs keep going up. So a lot of people have kind of gotten stuck in that wedge. Retirement finance is also a mess. As we know, back in the 80s, 401ks began supplanting traditional pensions. A lot of people haven't saved enough. Even people who did plan well got whacked in 2008. They followed that gospel that housing prices always go up and were taken by surprise. So a lot of people who never expected to become full-time nomads found that the way they could make it work financially was to take to the road, to cut out a mortgage, to cut out utility bills, and, you know, to travel and find jobs as they go.
Yeah, and the phrase jobless recovery and flat real wages, those phrases appear in your book more than once and have an effect on this particular group. One of the things that made your book so engaging was you didn't just talk about them as a sociological class. You spent a huge amount of time out there with them, participant observation, as they say, and you got to know a lot of them. And in fact, their stories really flesh out the parts that you talk about that are more about social policy and so on. And in particular, there's one woman that you kind of follow through the whole book, and her story was really interesting. Could you say a little about her?
Linda May, and when I met her, she was just coming up in her mid-60s. We met in Arizona when I was working on that magazine story, so gosh, it had to be 2014. Linda had just taken to the road. She had realized that after a lifetime of working all sorts of low-wage jobs, everything from a cocktail waitress to a defeather of quails at a hunting lodge. I mean, you name it, Linda's done that job. She'd also had time out of the workforce as a caregiver for her mom when her mom had terminal cancer, and basically realized that her Social Security earnings were going to come in at under $500 a month, which wouldn't even have been enough to rent the tiny trailer she was living in. At the time, she was working at Home Depot, but she wasn't getting enough shifts. As she got older, she had gone from being a project manager there, which she was really good for because she had lots of skills as a former general contractor, to just getting to work the register irregularly, which was, you know, a little bit ageist and definitely a waste of her talent. So she realized that unless she wanted to work those scant low-wage shifts until she fell down dead, she had to do something else. There had to be another way. She dreamed of building something called an Earthship, which is this marvel of 1970s passive solar eco design. And she had this whole plan. She's got a binder full of printouts with the building plans, but she had to find a way to bridge herself there. She went online. She did what we all do when we have problems these days. She Googled, and she found a website that said, hey, this is how you can live for $500 a month. And you do it by moving into an inexpensive vehicle and, if you need, traveling around to these different jobs. And basically just showed you how to pare your budget down to the bone. And that's how Linda May got out on the road. And she went out to work for a program that Amazon has called Camper Force for RVers. She went out to work as a campground host. And when I first met her in the desert in Quartzsite, Arizona, she had just come off those two jobs and was really just making that transition into finding this nomadic community and becoming, you know, a full-time member.
Yeah, and that was one of the interesting parts of your book for me. And I know you've written about different subcultures, and here it is. There's just like there is with maybe, I don't know, Civil War reenactors and people who follow certain types of music and so on. There's this whole online network. There's a bunch of books, and there's encampments and meetups, and then there are these jobs that many of these people you say they sometimes call work campers, take people who bring their home with them and go to work. But one of the things you point out is a lot of these jobs are not that great.
Yeah, I mean, because the people who do the jobs are seasonal labor, you know, we talk about how labor's power in the marketplace these days has eroded quite a bit. I mean, that's incredibly true when you look at people who are just on the job and will be moving on. It's not like they can really ask for much in terms of benefits. The wages are typically really low. The work is very physical, which for somebody in her 60s or 70s or sometimes even 80s might be more challenging than for younger folks. Often the jobs get marketed with the excitement, the freedom, the friends you'll meet on the road and all this other stuff. There's definitely another side to them where it's really quite difficult and low-paid work.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me as I was reading this book, and by the way, I should mention again, I'm talking to Jessica Bruder. She's the author of Nomadland, a very interesting read about people trying to make their lives living in their vehicles and working and traveling. And one of the things that struck me was the similarity to seasonal harvest workers, migrant laborers, and their work that became very well known by the work to attempt a union, which was eventually successful, the United Farm Workers. These were people, like you say, they were moving from place to place. They were subject maybe to not being able to get as good a work conditions as they could because of things like that. And, of course, the United Farm Workers did form a union, and you did mention that unions occasionally did try to work with the work campers.
Not the work campers specifically, to be honest. I know
they were trying just Amazon workers in general? Is that what?
Exactly. Different unions have come in and tried to organize folks through Amazon, but not the work campers as a demographic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but often it's funny. If you're on a harvest schedule, do you know what I mean? People are doing that kind of the same sort of liturgical calendar every year where it's like you're a farm worker and this is what you're doing. These people are so in and out. They'll do it one year. They want another. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
I think there are probably different challenges in terms of actually organizing.
In terms of a union trying to organize them.
Yeah.
One of the things you did do was come to North Dakota to work in the sugar beet harvest, though, and I can't really fault you for this. You didn't last that long, right?
Well, yeah, and part of me wanted to stick it out, but I think I was on a particularly difficult piler as well, because it turned out I'm not a quitter, but the problem was here I'm a writer and I was kind of behind and I did have to go home and write. But the other thing was I learned that within several days of my leaving, just about everybody on my crew had left.
So you were working, you weren't driving a truck, you were dealing with the beets as they were coming in, right? We all,
correct.
Living around,
if
you live in eastern North Dakota, you see those sugar beet trucks driving around when the harvest comes, and
you
know it's on.
Those trucks are crazy.
Yeah.
And the fact that you don't need a CDL, a commercial driver's license, I mean, it's really a free-for-all up there. You see the beets on the side of the road. I know there's been a lot of stress over, you know, are there lots of crashes? Should they be licensed? But one of the things that kind of blew my mind is that it gets called a campaign, as if this area in North Dakota is almost going to war, starting on October 1st. Do you know what I mean? There's that military, like, we got to get out there and get her done.
and it's going to run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, unless the weather gets in the way.
But the reason that you went there and participated in it and stuck it out for several days anyway was to really feel firsthand what the work was like, that these people, these seniors who've been squeezed out of the housing market and are living in their vehicles, the kind of jobs that they are able to get. And this is one of the kind of jobs they can do.
Absolutely. And as I'm sure many of your listeners know, it's not easy work. It's 12-hour shifts on your feet in the cold, on concrete. I met people who had already had entire lives and careers. There was one gentleman who'd driven truck for Walmart who was parked next to me at the campground and basically had to beg himself off the night shift because he was starting to go blind and just needing to shift to the day. And, you know, it was really, really hard work, particularly, you know, you meet a lot of older people with medical issues out there, too. Not easy work even for a younger person. I mean, when I was doing it, I just turned 40, but I was probably 37, 38 when I did it. And I figured, oh, if, you know, people are doing it in their 70s, this is going to be a piece of cake for me. And my body hurt. Like all those injuries you think hit the field and they all come kind of screaming back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things that struck me as I looked at around for reactions to your book and I read what some people had noted about it, it seemed to confuse some people because you paint in some ways a positive picture of these people. They're plucky, they're clever. Some of them come from relatively wealthy backgrounds. Some of them, like Linda May, have been working more different jobs and not high-wage jobs. But a whole mix, some with advanced degrees and some with lots of experience in different jobs. And here they are kind of just scraping by out on the road in their vans and their some even in sedans. Or some people felt like almost there was too much positivity in the book. But I think it was, people coming together in adversity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I kind of feel like that to neglect that, it's funny because there are other people who think the book is too dark.
Yeah, right, right.
So I kind of think if everybody's coming after you as a journalist, maybe you've done the right thing. Who knows? My attitude towards the story, which evolved quite a bit as I went in, you know, you go out there and the first thing anybody tells you is, I'm having this great adventure. And then you hang out for a week and then you hear about the foreclosure. And I realized there are a bunch of different narratives and counter narratives happening. And one is that the economy is terrible and it's a mess and there are not a lot of good paths for people who just want to make a day's wage and live a regular life. Like we are squeezing out our middle class. But at the same time, I met people who were downright heroic and resilient and creative, and they're not willing to be victims. They don't want to be characterized that way. And it's hard not to admire their spirit. So for me, you can't portray people walking around in sackcloth and ashes and saying, woe is me, if that's not what that's out there, right?
That's not how people live.
To give them their dignity and to give them their agency, but to also just show what incredibly long odds they're up against. For me, that was a really important line to walk with the book, was to hit both those points rather than trying to resolve them.
Does the thing that we're told by people from other countries is particularly American, this rugged individualism, does that play into the problems that we see facing out as people are going into retirement and facing some of the kind of questions that people face here? One of the things that struck me was like they were allergic to the word homeless, right?
Absolutely, because the word homeless, it doesn't mean what it purports to mean. It doesn't mean that you're someone that doesn't have a house. It's really, it's in as much as if we have a caste system in America, that's it. Homeless actually means subspecies. I mean, that's how people treat people they label with that word. And these people, again, they're resilient, they're clever. You really have to have it together to make a life like the way they're doing. It's not easy. They do resent that label, and they refer to themselves as houseless rather than homeless because they consider their RVs, their vans, their sedans, those are their homes. They have shelter and transportation. So I think it's almost like a reclamation to say, I'm houseless, I'm not homeless. It's saying, I have some agency, and I'm a person.
You wrote this book, Nomadland. I'm talking to Jessica Bruder, who's the author of Nomadland. You started with an article back in 2014, and that's not that long ago, but many things have changed since
then.
Feels
like a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah. So how is this story, you particularly focused on seniors, with a lack of resources for retirement, who dumped the real estate and got into a vehicle to live in it. Has that story developed more since you finished the book?
Oh, absolutely. So it's funny. I finished my reporting before the Trump administration began. And a lot of people, when they think of this moment and the moment the book talks about, they think of the current political moment. But the issues that I documented, these were things that were going on, you know, during the Obama administration, before then. Do you know what I mean? These are all really deep-seated issues in the culture.
Right.
And
2008 comes in a lot.
Yeah, they continue to grow. So we see more and more that cities all over the country are trying to institute no overnight parking laws. This community, there's a tighter and tighter squeeze on it. Some of the places where people were able to camp back when I was reporting, they can't camp in anymore. Meanwhile, there's been increasing coverage of different demographics. So, for example, all those RVs around Silicon Valley and in different spots of LA where people are barely traveling at all, but it's just, again, it's this hedge because of flat wages and high housing costs. So people who are doing work in the service economy in areas that are quite expensive to live in using RVs, and that creating or that becoming the epicenter of kind of these municipal conflicts. On the other hand, when I was almost finished with the book, that New Yorker story on van life came out, which cracks me up. I would argue that van life is a brand rather than a movement, in that the interesting thing there is I think a lot of millennials who are taking to the roads, and not all of them, but many of them are impacted by a lot of the same factors. Surely not retirement, but what about splat wages? Again, there are jobs out there now. We're seeing that unemployment is dropping, but wages are still flat, and housing is still expensive. So for a lot of younger people, they're saying, look, I'd better do this while, you know, I've got my health, and I can get out there, and I'm curious, and I want to run around, and what are the other opportunities there? So again, the positive spin on that is van life, but it's also deeply shaped by economic opportunity.
Yeah. We just got a couple of minutes left, Jessica, and I can't let you get away without saying something about part of Nomadland that I think a lot of people have run across, which is the campground host. If you ever camp or go through national parks or national forests or campgrounds of America, you see these people who are campground hosts. And that job it is not as fun and vacation-y as it's cracked up to be.
Yeah, it's marketed as very idyllic, and often it's in these gorgeous settings. So, again, it's easy to see why people might think it's like a paid vacation in paradise. But in truth, these jobs are often very physical. They're low paid. You're doing everything. Some of the companies that hire campground hosts, their uniforms kind of make you look like a ranger because essentially you're in a bit of a security role.
Uh-huh.
You're checking people in. You're babysitting rowdy campers. You're making sure fire pits aren't left on fire. You're shoveling out those ashes. You're cleaning the toilets 3 times a day. Just within the group of people I know who've done camp hosting, I know two women, one in her 60s, one in her 70s, who broke ribs on the job. Like it's serious labor, but I don't think people always think about what it means to be living on site with your job. You know, if campers want, they can come bang on your trailer at 11 at night and say they need help. You're never really off the clock. And a lot of people don't really get paid for all the hours they're worked. They're pressured often not to file for them. So, again, looks pretty good, but the reality is a little bit different.
Well, Jessica, congratulations on your book.
Thanks for having me.
Prairie Public's Bill Thomas in a discussion with author Jessica Bruder about her book, Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 5th. School closures have long been a measure aimed at slowing epidemics in North Dakota. Schools closed for weeks, even months, due to outbreaks of disease. The 1918 influenza pandemic locked down communities that fall, closing churches, theaters, and schools, and prohibiting public gatherings, but not every school responded the same way. Mandan schools closed in early October of 1918 on the advice of North Dakota State Board of Health. Neighboring Bismarck closed schools a day later by order of the city health officer. While out of school, Bismarck children had to stay at home and could not congregate. Special police patrolled the streets to enforce the order and bring in any children in violation. Parents of non-compliant children could be held responsible. People flooded Bismarck's city health officer with phone calls after schools closed, and after 1 month, Bismarck's city superintendent reopened the schools. To make up for lost time, Bismarck kids' holiday vacations were cut short. They were given just 3 days off for Christmas vacation, spring break was eliminated, and school officials planned additional intensive work for students in the spring. The day of the scheduled reopening, Bismarck schools actually remained closed to celebrate the news of the armistice that ended World War I. Other schools were closed for a longer period, much longer. It was just before New Year's Eve in 1918 that schools reopened in Langdon in northeastern North Dakota. They had been closed for more than 2.5 months. Even after reopening, children not feeling well were to stay at home. Lessons were lengthened. Another period was added to the school day, and work not essential to the subjects was minimized. Cavalier County's Board of Health thought of reopening schools in mid-November, but decided safety first. Schools in Milton reopened in early December, but as the town prepared for the Christmas season, a new wave of influenza struck. 2 people died in a day. A ban on public gatherings was subsequently reestablished. By this week in 1919, schools were going full blast in Nomimi in Bottineau County after 2 months' closure. But in orders issued 2 weeks before, the county's Board of Health still forbade all schoolchildren and teachers from attending any public gathering not connected to schoolwork, with the exception of church activities. One member of the board acknowledged the rule's strictness, but said the intention was to keep schools open for the remainder of the year. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and after the radio broadcast, you can hear any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Wednesday on Main Street, it's impossible to overstate COVID-19's impact on healthcare workers. We'll hear from Dr. J. Patrick Fawn, the medical director of CHI St. Alexius Hospital in Bismarck. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.